This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, Palestinian-American community leader Rasmia Oda convicted of immigration fraud in what her lawyer says was a political prosecution by the U.S. government. We speak with reporter Charlotte Silver.
I think for a lot of the activists organizing the rallies outside the courthouse every day, who have been organizing really across the country in support of Rasmia for this past year, they're very aware that this is an attack on their community.
Also, members of a recent African Heritage delegation to Palestine talk about making the connections between liberation struggles in Palestine and in the U.S. And news headlines from Palestine. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland. We first go to news headlines for the last month in Palestine. Violence flared in Jerusalem during the month of October as Israel restricted Palestinian access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and repressed protests against those restrictions. Israeli police in Jerusalem shot and killed two Palestinians in what may amount to extrajudicial executions. 32-year-old Palestinian Mutaz Hijazi was shot and killed after a raid on his home on October 30th. Israel named Hijazi as a suspect in the attempted assassination of Yehuda Glick, an American-born settler who leads a movement which seeks the replacement of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Dome of the Rock with the Jewish Third Temple. Glick was shot and seriously wounded on October 29th. The previous week, Abd al-Rahman al-Shaludi, a 30-year-old Palestinian man from the Silwan neighborhood of eastern occupied Jerusalem, was shot and soon died of his wounds on October 22nd after his car ran into a light rail station, quote, killing an Israeli infant and injuring eight others, including an Israeli woman who later died of her wounds, according to the United Nations monitoring group, OCHA. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, Urwa Hamad, a 14-year-old Palestinian child who carries U.S. citizenship, was shot in the neck with live fire and killed by Israeli forces in the Ramallah area village of Silwad on October 24th. Another boy was shot and killed by Israeli forces using live ammunition in Beit Likya village near Ramallah on October 16th. Residents and eyewitnesses said that 13-year-old Baha Samir Badr was returning from the village's playground and was not involved in confrontations with Israeli forces when he was shot. 45 Palestinians, including 12 children, were killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank since the beginning of the year through October 27th, according to OCHA. 26 Palestinians, including 4 children, were killed in the West Bank by the military in the whole of 2013. Another child was killed in the West Bank this month after she was hit by an Israeli motorist traveling on Road 60 near the Ramallah area village of Sinjil. 5-year-old Inas Shaukat Khalil died of her wounds, and another girl, 6 years old, remains seriously injured. Quote, since the beginning of the year, 14 similar incidents were reported, the majority of which occurred in the Hebron governorate, states OCHA. Meanwhile, in Gaza, more victims of Israel's summer assault died of their wounds, and the body of another was pulled from the rubble of a destroyed mosque, bringing the cumulative death toll among Palestinians killed during the 51 days of violence to 2,194, including 519 children. A 4-year-old child was killed in the northern Gaza town of Beit Hanun on October 22nd when unexploded ordnance detonated. 5 Palestinians have been killed by unexploded ordnance and 6 others injured since the August 26th ceasefire, according to OCHA. No rocket fire was reported from Gaza from the beginning of the month through October 27th, but Israeli forces continued to fire on and injure fishermen and farmers there. The Ministry of Health in Gaza warned of a humanitarian crisis in the territory's hospitals due to the chronic deficiency in electricity supply and lack of fuel to power backup generators. Israel bombed Gaza's sole power plant during its summer assault, and though the plant was repaired, it has remained shut down due to lack of fuel, resulting in power outages in the Gaza Strip of up to 18 hours per day. On October 14th, the first shipment of 2 tons of basic construction materials for the private sector was allowed to enter Gaza via Israel's Kerem Shalom checkpoint. Israel has severely restricted the importation of construction materials since 2007. Last month's delivery was the first shipment allowed by Israel since October 2013. UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, stated on October 30th that 18 of its schools are still being used as shelters for 32,419 Palestinians displaced during the summer assault. The agency added that at least 80% of the 100,000 Palestinian homes damaged or destroyed were refugee homes. Meanwhile, half of the 540,000 Palestinian refugees registered with UNRWA in Syria are internally displaced in the war-torn country, with more than 70,000 others displaced to other countries, most of them in Lebanon and Jordan, according to the agency. UNRWA installations across Syria were housing more than 6,000 internally displaced persons, of whom 9% were Syrians as of October 16th. UNRWA reported a significant decline since July in the amount of food and humanitarian aid the agency is allowed to distribute in Yarmouk refugee camp near Damascus, where 18,000 civilians live under siege. The agency's commissioner general warned that in Syria, quote, "We may be witnessing the beginning of a second long-term refugee community in the Middle East, the first being the Palestinians who have been subjected to waves of forced migration since 1948. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, estimates that 3.2 million Syrians have fled to neighboring countries and North Africa. And those were the headlines from our most recent Month in Pictures feature. For more, go to electronicintifada.net. Palestinian American community leader Resmia Oda was taken to St. Clair County Jail in Port Huron, Michigan, on Monday, November 10th, following a week-long trial that ended in a jury finding her guilty of immigration fraud. The case against Oda centered on her alleged failure to disclose on her U.S. immigration papers her conviction in an Israeli military court in 1969. However, Oda maintains that the conviction for alleged participation in bombings in Jerusalem was false and based on a confession she was forced to sign after 25 days of torture, including sexual assault. The judge in the trial prevented the jury from knowing that Resmia Oda signed the confession after being tortured in what her legal team said was a political prosecution. Oda faces up to 10 years in prison and deportation. Joining us to talk about the latest updates is the Electronic Intifada contributor Charlotte Silver, who has been covering the trial. She spoke to us on Tuesday from Chicago. Charlotte, thanks so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada.
Hi, thank you.
So Resmia was taken away in handcuffs on Monday afternoon. Talk about what happened and why she's been taken into custody until her sentencing months from now.
So the jury found her guilty after less than 2 hours of deliberation. And after the verdict was announced, the prosecution surprised the defense and Resmia by making a motion to have her bond on which she was released last October revoked, meaning she would be taken immediately into custody. And Resmia's lawyers had not prepared any sort of argument against this motion, but really didn't expect the judge to grant it to the government. It was based on, as Michael Deutsch said, Resmia Oda is fighting this charge because she wants to stay in America. That's why she didn't accept a plea bargain when they offered it to her last year. She doesn't believe that she committed a crime and she wants to stay in America. She doesn't want to be deported. There's no logical conclusion to reach that she is a flight risk. And she's also clearly poses no danger. But the judge did grant it and sort of surprisingly or maybe more tellingly, did so by invoking the fact that Resmia Oda attempted to escape Israeli prison in 1975. And he said, this is what you do when you don't respect the authority of a court. And because she had criticized the verdict that had been reached between the verdict being announced and the hearing in the afternoon on Monday, he said, I think you pose a flight risk because, and he also, which was very shocking, he said, I don't believe you have any community ties in Chicago that would keep you here. And this is after a week of seeing the courtroom full, packed, requiring a spillover room on the seventh floor for people who had traveled from Chicago to stay in Detroit to watch this trial. And he said, sort of dismissively, I think that you could, this is the kind of work you could really do anywhere.
That's the voice of Charlotte Silver, who's been reporting for the Electronic Intifada on the trial of Rasmia Oda. Charlotte, you reported also that the judge commented on the guilty verdict, basically praising the jury for convicting her, which is rare and proves really that he steered this case in the direction he wanted. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. After the jury announced their verdict, he said, I don't usually do this, but I think that the conclusion you reached was a fair and reasonable one. And, the jury doesn't know all the information that was not allowed in, which the judge prevented from getting in, which was that Rasmia was tortured for 25 days before being convicted, signing a confession, and then subsequently being convicted by an Israeli military court. They don't know anything about the Israeli military court, but they did hear repeated again and again that she was convicted of the bombing, of a series of bombings in Jerusalem that resulted in the death of two civilians. And they heard that countless times. And the parameters of the entire trial were so narrowed by Judge Drain that the verdict was really written from the outset of the trial.
Charlotte, what was the reaction from her supporters and her legal team to the way she was treated, not just in the unjust nature of the trial itself, as you mentioned, as the judge refused to let the full evidence about her torture and confession into the courtroom, but after she was convicted and handcuffed and taken to jail, what was the mood like in front of the courthouse and after the hearing?
Well, it was really brutal, and I think people were had braced themselves for a guilty verdict, but they really were not, they had no way of expecting that she wouldn't be coming home with them that day, and that she wouldn't be exiting the courthouse with them that day. And so there was a real somberness, there was sort of a stunned and shocked feeling across the crowd, many people crying, and there was a sense of like, they had this sort of momentum after every day of the trial. And Rasmia was really leading that momentum. She really showed such strength every day, and her absence was really felt.
In speaking with the lawyers and the Rasmia Oda Defense Committee, what's the next step?
So the judge has allowed Deutsch, or has offered him the opportunity, has offered her defense attorneys the opportunity to file for a motion to reconsider remanding her into custody until the sentencing. So that's what they're doing. That's what they've been doing today. And when I talked to them yesterday, they were planning on filing it as soon as Wednesday. So they're hoping to compile more information to counter the idea that she doesn't have community ties in Chicago that would keep her here and not make her not a flight risk. So because Deutsch wasn't prepared to argue that in court right at that moment, there is some hope that he will be able to put forth a strong argument. But at the same time, this judge has really revealed that he believes Ode to be a criminal and that she should be incarcerated. And the prosecution has indicated that they are going to seek no less than 21 months for her imprisonment, which is sort of, I guess, the maximum precedent. And she very well could face more than that, and if the judge wishes. And so that the sentencing hearing won't be until March 10th, which is when the judge Drain said was the soonest they could that it could take place. Hopefully there will be another hearing to allow her to be out on bond until then.
Finally, Charlotte, in your experience in covering this trial, what do you think this says about the nature of the U.S. government going after Palestinian social justice and human rights activists at this time?
Well, I think for a lot of the activists who were organizing the rallies outside the courthouse every day and who have been organizing really across the country and in support of Rasmia for this past year, they're very aware that this is an attack on their community. And this was the charge that prosecutors were able to get, were able to have stick, this charge of unlawful procurement of immigration, Rasmia Ode. But they were looking, they have an open investigation into 23 activists, Palestinian solidarity activists in the Midwest right now, and they've refused to close it. And so I think there is a chill factor going on, and that's one of the reasons why a lot of these people are mobilizing in support of Rasmia.
All right, well, that's the voice of Charlotte Silver. She's been doing an incredible job reporting from the Rasmia Ode trial in Detroit. She's speaking to us from Chicago right now. Charlotte Silver, thank you so much for all you've done and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks so much, Nora.
These were the people who'd open their doors to anyone. This was the mother who always cooked double cause anyone should drop by. Now she's mixing spice and water as the children just get thinner. When you're born a refugee, you build your life on nothing. Just a little room, then a little home, even a little shop. But they burn it all down now. When you're born a refugee, born knowing what survival means, you feed your dog. And you sing her songs, make her look her in the face now.
You're very hard to say, what do you say? What's the love you will have?
That was the track Yarmouk, When You're Born a Refugee, by Rast, a multicultural music collective based in London. Recently, the third African Heritage delegation, led by the Interfaith Peace Builders, returned from a two-week trip to Palestine, in which participants met with members of civil society, human rights workers, grassroots activists, and students struggling against Israeli occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid. We're delighted to have with us today Trina Jackson and Ajamu Baraka, two of the delegates who are on the trip. With nearly 20 years of community-based experience as a social justice organizer, Trina is a co-founder and coordinator of the Network of Immigrant and African American Solidarity, which builds trust and solidarity between African Americans and immigrants of color in Boston through dialogue. Ajamu Baraka was the founding executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network. He currently serves on the boards of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Africa Action, Latin American Caribbean Community Center, Diaspora Afrique, and the Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights. He's also an editor and columnist for the Black Agenda Report. Trina, let's start with you. Thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about why you joined this delegation and what you wanted to learn about the struggle of Palestinians under occupation and apartheid.
The Palestinian struggle, for those of us who are doing social justice here in the U.S., has always, you know, been part of our analysis in terms of thinking about, structural and institutionalized oppression. And I was interested in seeing a lot of what is the reality for people on the ground there. I was interested in talking to people about their daily lives and how they live their lives, under this oppression, under the occupation. And I was just interested in the stories and how people themselves would describe what, you know, what's going on. I also just wanted to, you know, be educated on some of the historical context for what's going on, and just feel like I could be a more informed ally from where I am.
And was this the first time that you had been to Palestine?
Yes, this is my first trip to the Middle East region. Yes.
You're involved in anti-racist organizing and social justice movements in the U.S. And in Palestine, you met with community leaders, human rights workers, political activists, and youth inside the occupied West Bank and in present-day Israel. What were the conversations like in terms of making connections between the struggles of Black communities in the U.S. and the struggles of Palestinian communities?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of it was thinking about, was seeing how, you know, the stereotypes and the that sort of exist in Israeli society, you know, how that's used to sort of justify a lot of the oppression. You know, a lot of our way of, well, in my way of thinking about it was, you know, what are the systemic and structural forces that are holding this occupation up? And for as African Americans and Black folks living in the U.S., that's very much the kind of fight and that we're waging is against the structural and the institutional pieces. So for me, I was looking for that level of analysis about what I was seeing.
Well, I think that the connections were somewhat obvious for both those of us who were part of the delegation and for Palestinians, especially those Palestinians who had taken an interest and had an understanding of the struggles of African people in the U.S. There is a recognition that the common bound for both of us is the struggle against oppression, the struggle against racialized societies in which the humanity of African people, African American people, and the humanity of Palestinians are not recognized. A recognition that in that common struggle to fight for our dignity and for self-respect and self-determination, there's also a recognition that our struggles go beyond just our immediate struggles for our own liberation, but that those forces that are conspiring to deny us our humanity are the same forces that are conspiring to deny the humanity of peoples all over this globe. So those recognition that those connections were made, and that's what made our conversation so powerful, because unlike some who might visit and have a sympathetic position on the situation in Palestine, there was something deeply moving for us who come out of situations where we are directly oppressed. There's a feeling there that I think the Palestinians also picked up.
That's the voice of Ajaan Mubaraka and Trina Jackson. Coming back to the U.S. at a time when we saw the conviction of Palestinian-American community leader Rasmia Oda, who was tortured and sexually assaulted for weeks by Israeli interrogators in the late 1960s until she signed a confession, and then convicted by an Israeli military court of participating in a bombing in Jerusalem, a charge she immediately recanted. Thrown into prison, and then just this week thrown into jail again by the U.S. government because of immigration fraud. The judge in her case refused to let the jury know that she had been tortured into signing a confession. We see the criminalization of Palestine solidarity activism in this country. We see the expanding attacks against communities of color and marginalized communities. What are your thoughts on the ways in which the struggle of marginalized communities from the U.S. to Palestine are being repressed, and how people are still standing up and fighting back?
Well, I think that there's a common recognition that the tide of history is on the side of the oppressed. And as we are able to make direct links between ourselves, we are able to provide the kind of solidarity that we need in order to defeat a common enemy. It's clear that in our struggles for liberation, that the very fact that we engage in resistance means that we're going to be criminalized. Yeah. That comes along with the territory. We understand that. And that's what we saw in the case you just cited, that basically a resistance to Israeli settler colonialism is a criminal act. Yep. And even though she may not have been physically in Palestine, she was here in the U.S. And their sister state, the U.S. government, U.S. state, continued to exert the kind of oppressive pressure on her that she would have felt if she remained in Palestine. So that we understand, and that's why we stand in solidarity, and we understand that basically, as Dr. King said, a threat, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So we stand in solidarity with our folks.
Yeah.
Trina, did you want to add to that?
No, I mean, I think what Ajamu said is the heart of it, you know, and that the criminalization, you know, is part of the larger strategy, you know, of trying to silence any kind of resistance. And so this is, you know, this is a strategy that's used by all kinds of repressive and regimes. So, you know, I think it is what we might expect with any level of resistance, whether it is the truth telling of our stories about, you know, what's happening to the spectacles of resistance that we're used to seeing in the media that tend to, you know, over, you know, that paint resistance as criminal. You know, it's part of the overall strategy. So like Ajamu was saying, it's something that, you know, as fighters, you know, we're accustomed to that.
Trina, you live and work in Boston. How are you relaying what you experienced in Palestine back to the work that you do as a social justice organizer there?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a very engaged community in Boston, you know, in support of the Palestinian struggle, but also against this, you know, Israeli occupation, and also like a deeper analysis of the ideology behind it. So, you know, there's a very engaged community. There's lots of spaces where people can come together and have dialogue about, you know, ways to either, you know, deepen your analysis or, you know, what you can do from wherever you sit in your life. And just integrate it into the work that you're doing on the ground, you know, dealing with local issues. So ways that people can make linkages between grassroots work that's happening in Boston, whether it's around violence or income inequality or gentrification, and making the larger leaps. And so what I've been trying to do personally is just connect with people and sharing my experiences and having some dialogue about how we can make connections.
Ajamu, you've written extensively on what you call the moral duplicity of the Obama administration, which is continuing the status quo of all administrations that have come before in terms of refusing to hold Israel accountable for its violations of international law and the continuation of this occupation and settler colonial project in Palestine. Can you talk about the work that needs to be done here in this country to hold Israel accountable and the part that grassroots civil society plays in this context?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I argued was we had to shift the paradigm on Israel-Palestine, and that is that we have to look at that situation as one of a colonial project, a settler colonial project, in which the settlers failed to recognize the existence, the humanity of the people of Palestine. And what makes that situation even more dangerous is that at this particular juncture in the history of Palestine, Israel, the Palestinian people are no longer of any value to the settlers. And we find that when you have a settler colonial situation where the main objective of the settlers is the land, and there's no interest in having to exploit the labor of the people, then we have found that the recipe for genocide is in place. And that is what we are, in fact, seeing in Palestine. We're seeing that basically because of the almost redundant nature of Palestinian labor, the social problem that Palestinians present by their very existence is being translated into policies of genocide. And gradually, there's been an acceptance in Israeli civil society around the notion that the only way they can solve this problem of the Palestinians is through an accelerated form of ethnic cleansing. So once we understand the real terms in Palestine, we need to be able to explain what's happening in Palestine in clear terms. We've got to strip away the language of all this obscure language about the possibility of negotiated settlements and all of that, and understand the clash of material interests, of historical interests, that when you have a settler regime like what you have in Palestine, that basically the only way that regime will be forced to negotiate and to surrender some of its power is consequently as a result of a horrendous, horrific a political struggle.
Trina Jackson and Ajamu Baraka, finally, talk about maybe one experience you both had in Palestine that you continue to think about, something that, that you probably won't forget.
You know, there are many that stand out for me. I think the ones that are right now at the top, at the forefront, is two things. You know, one would be the tear gassing incident that we had when we were in the village of Belin with a local resident of the village who has also been very active against the wall and the home demolitions. We were on a tour and he was explaining to us, you know, the impact, among other things, the impact of the wall on the people living in the village, and, you know, cutting off access to the land that they had, you know, used to either farm or build, you know, expand their own community. And we were tear gassed during the tour, and we weren't even on Israeli land. And so, you know, that, you know, it just spoke. I'd not been tear gassed before. I've certainly had, you know, my own interactions with, you know, police. It's hard not to be Black in America and not have any kind of interaction with the police. So, you know, that was somewhat familiar to me, but this was different. And, you know, it just spoke to the level of aggression that, you know, the Israeli government is about suppressing any kind of nonviolent resistance, which is just simply in the truth telling of people's lives, of Palestinian life. The second experience was visiting the detention center in the desert, in the Negev desert, the Halat, I think it was pronounced the Halat detention center, where we saw Africans from the Sudan and Eritrea who are being detained there really for no other reason that they're Black people that Israel does not want in the country. And they are isolated. They have no freedom of movement. There's no reason, you know, no one's communicated to them how long they're going to be there. And, you know, again, it just spoke to the level of just racist ideology that is fueling Israeli policies. And so for me, those were the two experiences that are still with me, still feel fresh.
I have to agree that the one of the experiences was, of course, the tear gassing there in Berlin. I guess for me, though, in that same village, beyond that tear gassing, what really stood out for me was that evening, as we got back to the houses, we had dinner, discussion, and then we began to socialize. And members of the village came around and they started talking and making jokes about what they were experiencing. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, the kind of spirit that these folks have. I mean, it's clear that the occupation it weighs on their spirit and their minds. It sort of consumes everything about that experience there in that space, you know. But yet, with that weight of oppression, they still found ways. I guess they had to find ways of bringing some humor into it, and they made jokes about things that happened between them and soldiers, and you know. And I'm thinking to myself, as long as these people exist, there will be resistance, and that this situation is not going to be resolved as long as the Israeli government is allowed to do what it's doing to try to destroy these people, because they can't be destroyed. And lastly, the visit we had with a representative of the settler community in Hebron, and I'm sitting there looking at him and seeing the vacant look in his eyes, his inability to connect with us as human beings. And it really struck me that if this is the attitude of these settlers, then again, this situation is not going to be resolved short of basically a situation of what we saw in Algeria with the liberation of Algeria.
Well, that's a good place to leave it. That's the voice of Ajamu Baraka. He's the founding executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network and currently serves on the boards of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Africa Action, Latin American Caribbean Community Center, Diaspora Afrique, and the Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights. He's also an editor and columnist for the Black Agenda Report. And Trina Jackson is a longtime social justice organizer and coordinator of the Network of Immigrant and African American Solidarity, which builds trust and solidarity between African Americans and immigrants of color in Boston. Thank you both so much for the important work you do and for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.